It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Senate Republicans denied the confirmation of the state's agriculture secretary last November, prompting strong criticism from the governor. We'll talk with the new interim person in that position about what he plans to focus on in 2020. First, keeping a diary isn't just for kids. As adults, we might prefer to call it a journal, but the act of writing things down, whether it's lists, what you did today, whatever comes to your mind, can have all kinds of benefits. Author and humorist David Sedaris has kept a diary since 1977. Here he is in an interview with The Atlantic talking about when he first started to keep a diary.
I was 20 years old, and I was in the Pacific Northwest hitchhiking around, and I wrote on the back of a placemat. And then the next day I did it again, and then the next day I did it again. I've wished that I had more interesting things to say, but I've never had to force myself to write in my diary.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you ever kept a journal or a diary in the past or right now? Did you do it as a kid, as a grown-up? What purpose has it served to you? What kind of things, if you're willing to share, do you write in it or draw in it or type in it? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Diane Barth is a New York City-based psychotherapist and writes the column Off the Couch for Psychology Today, where she's written about journaling. She's the author of several books, including I Know How You Feel, The Joy and Heartbreak of Friendship in Women's Lives. Diane, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Rob. Thanks for having me.
I understand, Diane, that you have kept some form or another of a journal for quite a while. What got you started?
Probably the same thing that gets every little girl started. Somebody gave me a diary and I started writing in it. And, for me, it was always fun. So, I just have written since I could write.
A lot of people have fun with their diaries or their journals, but it sounds like it can be kind of serious fun. What are some of the benefits to us of doing something, what if we call it a diary, journal, whatever?
Well, I want to back up for a second because a lot of people don't have fun writing in a diary or a journal. I mean, a lot of people are intimidated by it. So I want to preface this with the idea that part of what is nice is if you can find a way to make it fun, and that means taking off all the pressure. So there are lots of benefits to keeping a journal or a diary or some sort of record of your thoughts on a napkin or on a coaster from a bar. But the main things are it helps you clarify your thoughts. It helps you keep track of yourself. And it also, for a lot of people, it's a way of solving problems. And it turns out that there's actually some health benefit to it. I mean, if you write the kind of things where you're just writing out some of the difficulties that you're struggling with, it can relieve stress, and relieving stress can have a tremendous impact on your immune system.
Let's dig into
research for that.
Let's dig into your preface a little bit there. A lot of people, and I include myself, might think, okay, I'm going to try to do this, and I'll speak just for myself here, and I feel kind of silly. I got nothing to say. There's nothing important I'm going to write down here. How do we overcome that initial, I guess, self-consciousness?
Yeah. So there are lots of different ways of starting. And there are a million books about it, but one of the ones that I like is The Artist's Way. It's Julia Cameron. She just talks about every morning you get up, you write 3 pages. It doesn't matter what you say in the 3 pages. I think 3 pages for a lot of people is intimidating.
Oh, yeah.
So I say write a paragraph. And don't worry about what you're saying. I had a friend who was a writer many years ago who he didn't keep a journal in the morning. He got up and wrote in the morning, and he said he would just sit there. And this was, you'll see how long ago it was. He would sit in front of his typewriter and put a blank, white piece of paper into the typewriter, and he would just sit there till he had a thought, and then he'd write a sentence. And maybe that would be all he'd get out, or maybe that sentence would get him to write something else. But the easiest way to write, to start any kind of journaling, is just to give yourself a 15-minute period where you sit down and you You just write whatever comes to your mind. But there are other ways. So there are also, I was actually talking to my brother about this, who has been a longtime journal keeper. And what he uses his for problem solving. So his books are full of not paragraphs about himself, but like bullet points. You know, this is, here's the problem, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Here are the solutions, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And he says that writing it down for him means that he almost always comes up with a sixth or a seventh solution that he wasn't thinking about in his head.
Talking to Diane Barth, New York City-based psychotherapist. We're talking about keeping a journal or keeping a diary or daily lists or gratitude journal, whatever you want to call it. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your own experiences. Want to go back to a humorist, David Sedaris, famous a diary keeper, talk about what he does with some of his writings.
My advice to a young writer who wants to start a diary or keep one going is to not read over what you wrote yesterday, because it's going to stink. Do it for a year before you go back. Just give yourself some distance.
What do you think about that, Diane? The idea of don't read it tomorrow, whatever you happen to write, but it's more worthwhile to go back with some time between the writing and the reading.
Absolutely. And there are some people who never read what they wrote. And the thing is, I think it's important to remember that you don't have to want to be a writer for journaling to be useful. So you can write down your thoughts and never, ever go back and look at them. It's not important. Some people do. Some people go back and look. One person was telling me that they went back and looked at old things to see where they were in terms of a particular issue or something that they're struggling with, where they were last year, where they were 6 months ago. I couldn't do that with my journaling because I don't keep any kind of track of it. So I wouldn't know how to find the same problem. And by the way, I do my journaling by hand. So I can't look up a keyword on the computer. But I think that what David Sedaris is talking about is really important, which is that it's important not to censor yourself. And if you go back and look at what you wrote yesterday, chances are good you're going to want to edit it and censor it, even if you're not doing it for, to be a writer.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Tina is with us in Kenosha. Tina, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I started keeping a diary when I was a young girl, the Dear Diary, got it as a Christmas present. And I do that now for my grandnieces. I buy them a diary every Christmas since it's the end of the year and the beginning of the new year. I had all those for a long, 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 long time. And then probably in my 20s, I threw them all away, and I am so mad at myself.
Oh, no.
Oh.
And then I journaled for many years in my 30s and 40s, and then I stopped doing it. I still have them, and I think it's value, what the other guy said, to look back at that, because I have done that. I've read journals, and then I say, oh, my God, I'm living the same life I did then, or the same problems. And especially back in my 20s and 30s and 40s, it was either a relationship or a situation or whatever. Well, I decided when I bought this year's journals for my nieces, and I also bought one for my nephew, is to get one for myself and start doing it again.
Oh, great.
Because I'm finding that I have too many thoughts in my head, and that if I do write them down, there tends to be more clarification.
Tina, thank you so much. Diane, what do you think of Tina's story?
Oh, well, there's so many important points there. One is that we often throw away our old journals and live to regret it. But on the other hand, we don't always go back and look at them. So even if you keep them, sometimes you never go back. But in terms of using your journaling to clarify your thinking, I think that's really what it's all about. And I think that's part of why it's important not to censor yourself, because it's really it's a chance to think out your own thoughts. And in this day and age, when we're all so anxious and stressed, it's also a chance to sort of not just get some clarity about what you're concerned about, but sort of let it out, let it just be somewhere so you can almost dump it out of you and let it be on the page. And then I also think that what she was saying about clarifying your thoughts is a way of making sure that you're not holding on to thoughts that are problematic for you.
And one quick thought. Everybody's getting little girls' journals, it sounds like, and young girls. Yeah. I never got a journal. What's up with that?
I thought it was so neat that she said that she bought one for her nephew. It, I mean, it is so often thought of as something that girls do, but boy, I have a young guy who I worked with who was going off to college, and he decided to keep a journal as a way of sort of staying in touch with the work we had been doing.
Talking to Diane Barth, New York City-based psychotherapist and author. She writes a column in Psychology Today. She's written about journaling there, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you keep a journal of some sort, however you define it? What kind of things do you keep track of? Do you go back and read them later? Call 800-642-1234, or if you need some inspiration, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with psychotherapist and author Diane Barth. She writes a column in Psychology Today. She's written there, among other things, about the benefits of keeping a journal. That's what we're talking about. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your stories or questions, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go back to our callers now. Andy is with us in Escanaba. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Rob. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Andy.
Typical in a relationship, in a marriage, there's a lot of sometimes difficult times, and I find if you keep your feelings bottled up, they come out in snips and barbs and temper tantrums, and I was not feeling comfortable with how things were going. I started journaling, writing down what had happened, how I felt about it, trying to get the thoughts out of my head so they didn't come out as a barb that was damaging, and trying to look at them on paper for a day, and I did that for about a week, and then I opened it up one day, and my wife actually started answering all my issues on the bottom, telling me I was a jerk, I got it wrong. Yeah, the whole perspective is selfish, and I had no business having those feelings. And that was the last time I journaled.
Whoa. Okay, Andy, a cautionary example there, Diane. Journaling might be best done solo.
Well, or not, but it needs to be agreed on.
Right.
I think the problem is that was your private journal, and somehow it wasn't allowed to be private. But that's a really, really common thing that we journal, and then somebody else gets hold of it, and then we have to deal with their reactions to whatever we've journaled. I think it really is important to make sure that you've got a way of keeping it private. Or if it's going to be something that somebody's going to see, to be ready to find a way to interact with them over it.
Thanks a lot for that call. Sorry that happened. And Diane, assuming we can keep it out of other people's hands, can you talk about the value of working through maybe those conflicts in our daily lives, as he was trying to do in a journal of some sort?
Yeah. I mean, I thought that was that's a great way of talking about it. Sorry. Now, I do think
That's okay. I'll give you just a minute to clear your throat. We're talking to Diane Barth, psychotherapist. We're talking about journaling, keeping a journal, keeping a diary, a gratitude diary, a list of stuff you did today, whatever you want to call it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm sorry, Diane, you were saying?
I think that writing out your conflicts and trying to get a handle on them is one really important way of using a journal. It's also, journals can be so many other things as well. So I think it's really important not to just think that that's the only way to have them. I was thinking about your question about, do boys journal? And we've got some examples of famous men who journaled a lot, including Leonardo da Vinci. I mean, his notebooks are famous, and he wasn't just talking about feelings. He was also talking about his design ideas, or he was writing about his design ideas and also designing his design ideas. So some journals are not private, but I do think that one of the important things is when it is private that you make sure that you keep your stuff separate or in a place where other people won't get to it. I worked with one man who whose wife had been a major journaler, and he had never read any of the things that she wrote, and then she passed away, and he destroyed all of her notebooks. And her children were very upset because they felt like he had thrown away something that was maybe would have given them some insight into her or helped them stay close to her. And he said, no, it really was her private world, and it wasn't for anybody else, and he wasn't going to let anybody else read it.
Let's go back to our callers now. Paul is with us in Platteville. Paul, hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
What did you want to bring up, Paul?
So it's funny, I actually called about kind of the same thing that Andy was talking about, not specifically personally, but I was curious what your thoughts were on having journals be public versus private, and, you know, and talking about getting one for my daughter, you know, the cute little ones with lockets on it. Do I encourage her to let us read them or let her make the decision or encourage her to have them be public?
Oh, interesting. Thanks for that call, Paul. What do you recommend to a parent getting that first diary for a daughter in this case?
That is a really, really important question. And I think that I would start out with the idea that it is hers and that it is her private place to write whatever she wants to, but that if she would like to share it with you, you would be happy to share it with her. And the way I would work it is to either let her read to you out of what she's written, or let her sit with you while you read it so that you can, it becomes a discussion. It's not a way of sneaking in and finding out something about her. And that's something I think that you and she have to sort of talk about together, but I think it's really important that it be a discussion, that it not be something that you do without her knowledge or permission, but also that she doesn't feel that she has to make it public.
Thanks a lot for the call. Let's go now to Tiffany in La Crosse. Tiffany, hi.
Hi. So I was telling what I had found after like this whole journaling craze had kind of come back up was the journals with journaling prompts in them. So it was kind of like a little snippet of like write about your favorite picture or write about this kind of memory or something like that. And a lot of them, like there's themed ones where I found like for expecting mothers so they could kind of like write about their childhood and then give that to their child as they grew up. And I really enjoyed those. I think even like the person who just can't get a grip on journaling, those are just perfect.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think that's for everybody, but that's the whole point of journaling. There's so many different ways to do it. And that's a really great one for someone who's having troubles just sort of finding something to write about.
Thanks a lot for that call. That reminds me, we heard from Mary on Facebook who writes, I've kept a journal for my 21-year-old son since 3 months before he was born. Not every day, just when the spirit moves me. Events, anecdotes, family history, a recipe, reflections, and always love and appreciation. That's an interesting approach, too, writing it for a kid as they grow up.
Yes, yes. And I think it can also be a wonderful experience for a kid. I think what Mary said is so important, that she kept it with love and appreciation, that it's really important that a journal that you're that you're writing for somebody doesn't have criticism and negative things. It can have funny stories. It can have memories of times that were hard, but it's important that if it's going to somebody else, that it maintain a positive way for them to think about themselves.
Let's go back to our callers. Marilyn is with us in Crivitz. Marilyn, hi.
Hi. Nice to speak with you this afternoon. This is a subject that's pretty dear to my family. My 104-year-old grandmother has kept a journal, daily journal, since she was very, very young. Yes, and she started every entry out with the date and the weather, indicating the temperature and whether it was cloudy or sunny. And she meticulously recorded current events, government, political-type events, because she was always very interested in that, as well as just details of everyday life. She lived through the Depression, obviously, through some very hellacious wars and things, and, of course, everyday family life. About 10 years ago, she put together her autobiography using the notes in her journal.
Wow.
And that consists of five subject spiral-bound notebooks like you would use in school that have the folder dividers in them, and the dividers are just chock full of photographs and newspaper articles and other memorabilia, and they're all handwritten. So there's five of those, and we also still have all of her journals, and believe me, there's a lot of them.
What a treasure, Marilyn. Thank you so much. Not everybody's going to go to that level, Diane, but what a great thing to have, isn't it?
Yes, yes. So what a gift to your children and grandchildren.
Thanks a lot for that call. Time for one more caller. I think Heather is with us in Madison. Heather, hi.
Hi. I was wondering if you think it matters if you write it out in longhand or type it, because for me, I'm not a very good typist. When I type, I'm trying to concentrate on how to spell the words correctly with, you know, where my hands are going with the keys, not so much necessarily the thought per se.
Heather, thanks a lot.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Diane.
I'm just so glad you brought that up, Heather, because that is such a question. There are people who believe it is only going to work if you do it longhand, and there are people who believe it doesn't matter, and there are people who believe that it's only going to work if you do it on a typewriter. And my feeling is it doesn't matter, that you do whichever one makes the most sense for you. I know people who do, who have reams and reams and reams of notebooks filled with longhand, and I know people who have just it's on their computer. The thing that I think is really important is what we were talking about before, is the privacy issue, and that if you if it's on a computer, or you know, blogs are a way of journaling. A lot of people keep blogs, and there are all sorts of online sites for doing journals that are supposed to be private. The thing that I always worry about is if it's on a computer, if it's on somehow on the internet, how private is it in fact?
Diane, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us. That's Diane Barth, New York City-based psychotherapist, writer of the column Off the Couch at Psychology Today. She joined us for a look at journaling. You can keep sharing your thoughts over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. The Wisconsin Senate voted in November not to confirm Brad Paff as Secretary of the State Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. That drew strong criticism from Governor Evers, who accused Republicans of playing politics in the midst of a crisis for dairy farmers. While 2020 looks like a better year for milk prices, farmers are still dealing with the impact of several down years and the uncertainty of trade disputes with other countries. Randy Romanski is now the interim secretary of DATCAP. Secretary Romanski, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for taking the time to reach out to us. We're happy to join you.
Well, it's a strange entry into your job right now. We had the former designee to the job, Brad Pfaff, effectively fired by the Senate when they voted not to confirm him. Does that color the job for you in some ways? Does it make your relationship with lawmakers more difficult than it might have been?
Well, it's unfortunate that the Senate voted against confirming former Secretary Designee Pfaff. I don't think anyone wanted it to happen this way. Obviously, for the agency and our team here, we clearly didn't want to see that happen. But I don't know that that's what the legislature really wanted to have happen. Now that they look back on it too, that's really for them to consider. There was considerable surprise and disappointment at DATCAP when that happened, because Brad was genuinely very well liked here. Having said that, DATCAP has been through transitions before. The staff here are resilient and committed to doing their jobs no matter what. So, the goal is to just encourage everybody here to continue to do the good work they're doing on behalf of the citizens of the state and working to serve as a partner to farmers, the agriculture industry, consumers, and trade associations.
Well, let's get into some of the issues facing Wisconsin agriculture and the other parts of your job there. Let's start with dairy farmers. We just talked on the show the other day. We had this big drop in the number of dairy herds in the state, 10%, I think it was, in 2019. What do you focus on when it comes to dairy issues in Wisconsin?
Well, I guess I would start by saying that the dairy industry is an integral part of our state's heritage. It's part of who our state is today, and we at the agency believe that it will continue to be a very important part of our future. Now, having said that, we clearly are identifying that we are aware of the fact that there are a lot of challenges in agriculture, not just dairy farming, but in agriculture. And there are a lot of contributing factors to that, too. With dairy, you're talking about low milk prices, but there's also trade uncertainty that's played a substantial role, at least in the recent past, and some severely challenging weather that have kind of added into that. So there's no question that there are some serious challenges in agriculture in Wisconsin. The way our agency approaches that is there's no one magic answer. There's no nothing that this agency can do to magically change that. Our responsibility and our role is to serve as a resource to farmers and to the agriculture industry. Work in collaboration with federal, state, and local industry partners, with the university, and just do our best to continue to support the dairy industry.
Wisconsin re-legalized industrial hemp farming through a pilot program that was a couple years back. Now we're going into our second full year of farming. What are you seeing when it comes to what the state can do and what the state needs to do when it comes to regulation and working with farmers on hemp?
Well, 2019 was the second year of Wisconsin's newly revived hemp industry. We issued more than 1,800 licenses to grow and process the crop. That's a 600% increase from 2018. So there is substantial increase in hemp as a commodity in the state of Wisconsin, and our staff that deals with that is relatively small. And having said that, they traveled to 70 of the 72 counties across the state and collected more than 2,000 samples of hemp. I'm just trying to cover kind of the details and how we interact with the industry and with growers on this particular issue. What we've seen thus far is that the interest in hemp is not waning either. As we've opened up this next year of applications, the interest in early applications remains strong. One of the other things that we've tried to focus on, and the governor's budget provided some additional resources for our agency. Because we have such limited staff capacity for hemp, but we've continued to engage with legislators on both sides of the aisle in both houses on the Hemp 2.0 Act, which the governor recently signed into law, that provided some much needed updates to hemp laws and really positions our state to align with federal hemp rules as we move forward.
If there's a farmer out there listening right now who's been thinking about getting into this renewed hemp business in Wisconsin, what do they need to know?
Well, that's a really good question. What I would start with is that any venture, especially one that hinges on things like weather and elements, there is an element of risk associated with it. So if somebody is out there and they have never ventured into growing crops before, they should just do a serious risk assessment. I think it's always valuable to talk to other people in the field, other growers. It's always a good idea to consult with the university or extension offices, things of that nature, to do some really sound background. Another thing to think about, so that's the front end. Something to think about on the back end, too, is consider what your market might be before you plant. There are various varieties. Some are, some kind of varieties are more adaptive to the climate here in Wisconsin, and that's something to think about as well. It's more back end, but as people are assessing whether or not this is something they want to get into, just weigh the potential risks with the potential rewards.
Talking to Randy Romanski, Interim Secretary of Wisconsin's Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. We've focused on agriculture so far. Are there priorities you have when it comes to the consumer protection side of your gig?
Yes, absolutely. And thank you for asking that question, because we always people sometimes refer to us as DATCAP by our initials, or sometimes the Department of Agriculture. And it's really important, and we make sure that we talk about the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. We can talk a little bit about trade as well if you have time. But consumer protection is a very important component of what this agency does. One of the things that I think we'd like to highlight is that Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection, or DATCAP, has a Data Privacy and Security Advisory Committee that's been established. It's comprised of a variety of stakeholders in the data security field, and they are getting together to consider the challenges and also develop potential legislative options to address data security challenges that face both consumers and businesses in Wisconsin.
And briefly, just about out of time, the trade side of things.
Yeah, the trade side of things. So earlier when we were talking about the dairy industry and the challenges that we're facing right now, one of the things that our agency can and does focus very heavily on is finding and opening new markets or expanding existing markets for products. Our international business team has been in countries throughout the world. We just hosted a delegation from Heilongjiang, China. They've been to the Middle East to promote markets. Obviously, Canada, China, and Mexico are strong, historically strong trade partners for Wisconsin. Due to some international trade difficulties, there's been a little bit of a decline in all those countries. So our agency does a lot to work with farmers and organizations to promote those trade opportunities.
Secretary Romanski, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Randy Romanski is the Interim Secretary of the State's Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. He joins us to talk about his goals for the agency for the year ahead. Race and racism are complex topics to discuss in general, but what about teaching about them? Professor Cindy Kernahan tackles that topic in her new book. She draws from her own experience as well as others to offer academics and leaders a way forward, and amounts to a game plan for being sensitive but effective educators. The book is called Teaching About Race and Racism in the College Classroom, Notes from a White Professor. Cindy Kernahan is a professor of psychology and assistant dean for teaching and learning in the College of Arts and Sciences at UW River Falls. Cindy, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Well, why is it important to teach about racism in a higher education setting? And in addition to maybe the conversations we might have in our daily lives?
Well, I think it's important in higher education because there's been a fair number of reports that show that students in K-12, most K-12 in the United States, don't get a lot of education around race and racism. And so, and there's also been studies that show that a lot of kids and parents don't talk about race, particularly white children and white parents don't talk a lot about race. And we live in an increasingly diverse society. Racism is a problem, but nobody's comfortable talking about it. So I think in the safe confines of a classroom, it's really helpful to sort of give students some racial literacy and then also some practice at talking about it in a way that's civil and fairly comfortable, so that then they're more comfortable when they go out into the world.
And one challenge here, and this is a lot of what your book is trying to tackle, is the concern that it might not be a safe place where the instructor, the professor might get backlash that ends up going viral, or a student might feel like they're going to say the wrong thing. And how do you start to resolve that and smooth that out so you can actually have a productive conversation?
Well, so the second point you made about students feeling uncomfortable, I can tell you that every semester when I teach this, my first question often is, how do you feel? What are you most concerned about? What are you most excited about? And what are you most concerned about? That's a standard question that I ask. And almost always the most concerning thing that my students say is, I'm so worried that I'm going to say the wrong thing. And so one thing that does right away is to sort of diffuse that, because students realize that they aren't the only ones who feel that way. Everybody else in the room, almost everybody else feels that way too. So we have some conversations about that, and about, you know, terms and terminology, how to think about talking about it. But the main way that I start out dealing with that is just to let them know that they're not alone in that feeling. And that diffuses a lot of it. It also, I think, helps to have some structure and some rules, which we develop on the first day together as a class, because that way they know that it's not just a free for all. It's not just people's opinions. And they have these funny ideas, you know, that it's going to be this really brawly sort of place, like people are going to yell at each other and throw chairs or something.
But, show, yeah.
Exactly. That's what I say, although they don't get that reference anymore, but at all. But they realize quickly that, you know, our students are so generous with each other. They're so kind with each other. And usually, you know, if you're careful and you're thoughtful about it, I think you can set up the environment pretty easily right away.
Another challenge you write about, and we've talked about this before, is that the way the word racism is commonly used is different than the way it's often used among people who study and are expert in racism. What do you see as the difference between those two?
So the main difference that I identify is that when you talk to most Americans, and there's a good survey data on this too, it shows that most Americans tend to think of racism as an interpersonal thing, interpersonal prejudice or interpersonal meanness. So one person being mean to another person, and that certainly is something that happens. But the more, I would argue in some ways, the more important thing to recognize is that comes from a larger set of institutional policies, American history, what some people would call structures that are kind of invisible to a lot of Americans. And so that those of us who are sort of experts in racism, we're really comfortable talking about that and understanding it. We can see how that flows into the individual piece. But for non-experts on it, for students who are coming in new, they don't know that. And it's not surprising that they don't know that. And so that's, I think, the biggest gap that you have to kind of get around is starting to understand that. Once they see it, it's kind of like a threshold. It's like once they cross it, they're pretty comfortable with it. They like knowing that information. But getting there takes a little bit of work.
Another possible challenge could be if you have white students in the class and students of color, they might be coming from very different places. How do you navigate that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it is difficult. And, you know, we at UW-River Falls have this unique situation of having lots of students who are suburban Twin Cities kids who might come from a more diverse set of schools. And then a lot of kids from the small towns in northern and central Wisconsin. And so you do get that, and you do see that. A couple things I like to do is, again, just setting up the rules and the structure. A lot of research shows that when you structure conversations, people are more comfortable and they're more willing to, you know, take risks and do more thinking. So that's one thing. I make sure that everybody's coming from a same shared content. So it's not just a discussion. It's a discussion based on what they've all read. And I set up structures to make sure as best I can that they do the reading before they come to class. So there's that. And the other thing I like to do is when I have students of color, and I don't have a lot of them because, you know, our campus is about 86% white students. But when I do have students of color, I like to send them an email early in the semester and just tell them, you know, I know that your experience of this is going to be different, and you don't have to speak on behalf of your racial group. That's not required. You can share what you want to share or not share. That's up to you. And I send that to them, just me and them, so that they know that I respect their experience. I'd still expect them to learn, obviously, the same things, but I know that they're maybe coming from a different frame of reference. And I've been told, at least by students, that they find that helpful.
Talking to Cindy Kernahan from UW-River Falls about her new book on teaching about race and racism, especially in higher education settings. That said, Cindy, are there lessons that you can take from what you're talking about in a college classroom to talking about racism in our daily lives?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's more challenging because you don't have, you know, I can't grade people, so I can't sort of make them read stuff and make them follow the structure that I have. But I do think that you can, So I talk a lot in the book about trying to be compassionate, trying to understand where people are coming from, also trying to see that, like, it makes sense that most Americans don't have what I would call a lot of racial literacy. We're not taught it, and we don't talk about it a lot as children with our parents. And so, especially for white people, there's just a lot of lack of experience. We're very segregated in America, so we don't see each other's experiences very well. So I do think that some of the compassion pieces, and also I would say I talk a lot in the book about trying to learn more history, and I think that's something all Americans can do. I have an appendix with lots of books for further reading that I suggest. And I do think while it makes sense that a lot of folks don't have a lot of understanding, people can get that understanding and they can use that. I also think it's important to believe other people and trust their experiences. If you're told about something that someone experienced that was discriminatory, believe them and listen to them. And that can help a lot too. And that's what I mean by compassion, understanding where people lack experience and understanding, and also respecting people's experience.
Another concern you run into in classes is, and this is for the white students in particular now, the concern that they might have that, wait, are you saying I'm the bad guy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's always challenging. And it's hard because, there's always a question, you know, I'd say 3 to 4 weeks into a semester where almost always a white student will say to me, well, what about the other side? And what they mean usually is, because we cover some history up front in the course, what they mean is, where's the history that shows that white people were discriminated against? And I always say, I appreciate that question, but I can't show you that history. I could certainly show you the social class types of discrimination. And we do talk a lot about how poor white people, you know, have experienced classism, but that's not the total focus of my class. It's on racism. And so I always have to sort of explain, it's not like there's two equal sides of this. American history is what it is. And so again, I think you have to be thoughtful. You have to bring evidence. You have to make sure people are reading. But in that way, you can sort of explain to students, like, here's this history. That doesn't mean you're a bad person. And that, again, gets to that separation between sort of the individual level of racism and the institutional level of racism, which I think is deeply helpful for students because they can start to see, oh, this isn't so personally indicting. One of the big things I want to get across when I teach is that, you know, racism is a moral problem, but it's not only that. And you're not an immoral person if you subscribe to racist ideas. We all do. I think it's then your responsibility to do something with that knowledge and to try to work beyond it. But it makes sense that people have those ideas because those ideas are reinforced for us. So seeing that separation between what I do individually and then what these larger structures is, I think can be sort of freeing in a way.
And getting back to the point of structure in the conversation, I think sometimes people point toward just talking about an issue like racism as the solution, if we could just open up dialogues. But it sounds like without a good structure, without some kind of common ground at the beginning, it might make things even worse.
Yeah, it could. I mean, I think this is where expertise can sometimes be disregarded, and it's important. And I don't want to make it sound like you have to be a professor to be an expert. I mean, like I said, you can read a lot of stuff on your own and learn quite a bit. I mean, you have to be thoughtful about the sources that you're using, but you can learn quite a bit. So I think that, yeah, you want some structure. You want to be operating from some evidence, because if all people are doing is just talking from their own personal experience, that's going to be just so limited. And it's not going to, you know, we're all in, we all have small sample sizes, right? So understanding the larger institutions and the larger history that we're all coming from, I think, is really, really helpful. And yeah, having some structure, I think, can be helpful.
Cindy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much.
Cindy Kernahan is a professor of psychology and assistant dean for teaching and learning in the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls. We talked to her about her new book. It's called Teaching About Race and Racism in the College Classroom, Notes from a White Professor. She draws from her experience teaching on those topics at UW-River Falls and that of her colleagues as well. Again, the title, Teaching About Race and Racism in the College Classroom. Yesterday at this time, Judith shared a story about a class ring that was lost and then returned many years later to its Wisconsin owner. Now there's another lost ring story in the news, this one from Yankton, South Dakota. As reported by KDLT News, a woman in Yankton lost her wedding ring the week before Thanksgiving last year. After searching her home and going through garbage bags, she thought maybe she'd lost it at the business she owns, where she makes caramel corn and sells it in bags. Lots and lots and bags of caramel corn. Uh-oh. So she tells every customer the next day, watch out for a wedding ring. You get free popcorn for life if you find my ring. No luck there. But she did end up getting her wedding ring back a month later. Follow the popcorn trail with me. At one point, she donates a bunch of leftover popcorn to a local church. The pastor gives some of the popcorn to a school. The school serves the popcorn for a Christmas party. The school secretary is cleaning up after the party and wondering, should I throw away this leftover popcorn? She sees something shiny, and there it is. She tracks the provenance of the popcorn, and the ring ultimately finds its way back to the original owner, who says she'll never, ever wear the ring while making and bagging popcorn ever again. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.